The hour 10:15 have arrived. We'll call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. And we're very happy to have the department with us today, Commissioner Bowerly and Mr. Cummings. To start off here, and what we're going to do, members, we're going to start off where we left off last week. We want to give the department all the time they need to present my bill. And then what we'll do is, just so folks who wish to testify, I have a list, and you can see the list over there on who's wants to testify. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify that's not on the list? For the Davids bill or for the Davids bill? Okay, we have your name? Okay, so we will put you on the list. And for those who are ready to testify, 2 minutes. We're going to cut you off like... We're going to cut you off in 2 minutes. So we will be holding to that because we have a lot of people who want to hear the basic thoughts of what everybody needs to put on the record here. So, tax related to my bill, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your reference for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Cynthia Bowerly. I represent the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We are pleased to be back with you this morning to continue our presentation of the governor's tax bill. We will not be starting at the beginning. We will pick up where we left off. We appreciate that there are many members from the public who also wish to testify. So Mr. Cummings and I will go through the remainder of the provisions of the governor's tax bill. We, of course, happy to answer any questions that you may have along the way. Just want to do remind the committee that the governor and lieutenant governor's tax bill, the provisions that we shared with you last week, are primarily focused relief on Minnesota's families and farmers, and on providing local governments with aid to continue to provide essential services while taking the pressure off local property taxes. As I said, we have just a few more provisions to cover with you today. The first of those provisions where we left off last week is the provider tax extension. The provider tax funds essential health services for Minnesotans. For example, about 100,000 Minnesotans today are covered by MinnesotaCare, which is funded in part with a provider tax. Other Minnesotans are covered by medical assistance, which provides low-cost coverage to the state's lowest-income residents, also partially covered, funded by the provider tax. In addition, grant programs such as the statewide health improvement grants are funded across the state. It's for communities to work with public health partners to improve health outcomes for Minnesotans across the state. These Minnesotans rely on these programs to provide access to medical care across the state and important health services. So that we are able to continue to provide these essential services for Minnesotans, the governor and lieutenant governor recommend repealing the sunset on the 2% taxes on hospitals, ambulatory surgical centers, providers, and wholesale drug distributors contained in Chapter 295 to fund those services. Mr. Chairman and members, we know there's a lot of conversation happening around health care and particularly health insurance and how to make sure that people have access to high-quality health care in Minnesota. We appreciate that this piece is in the committee's jurisdiction, but we also recognize that there are many conversations happening around the provider tax and the essential services that are provided to Minnesotans through it right now.
What's up, Hurtos? Did you want to finish the presentation and then go to questions?
No, I think we'll go, if it's okay with the commissioner, we'll go with questions as we go along, kind of like we did the other day on this. This format seemed to work pretty good the other day. What's up, Hurtos?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Bowerly, I'm really troubled about talking about extending this tax. We're trying to make health care more affordable for everybody, not just a few. And I noticed on the spreadsheets that when in fully effect, we're looking at $1.6 billion of adding cost to every average day Minnesotans in terms of the cost of their health care. So I think this is a step in the wrong direction. We really need to do as much as we can do to be expanding access to the individual market and to making the individual market stronger rather than making it smaller, and spread the risk and increase the base on that. Also troubling with the 2% provider tax is the idea that so many of our county hospitals, Ramsey and Hennepin in particular, have a disproportionate mix compensated care through Medicaid, which is a fractional percent of their fee-for-service, discounted from what would be a private pay individual market, and insurer would pay the bill on behalf of that subscriber, where Medicaid, Medicare are paying fractional percentages. In the case of HCMC, for example, 75% of their revenue mix is not from the private market, but from reimbursements from Medicaid. So when they're fractionally getting 76 or 78 cents on the dollar, and then we add this 2% provider tax on top of it, it's further reducing their net payments in terms of trying to provide service to our community. So not everything is a playing field, and we had a bill we talked just recently in this committee about exempting HCMC and Ramsey from the provider tax, but I strongly believe that this is a step in the wrong direction if we are talking about creating access and health care access to those less privileged in our community. We've got to take a different approach than putting this 2% tax. It doesn't do anything to put one more customer in the seat of that dentist's chair or in any other private clinician's chair. It's just really regressive. Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And in kind of relation to Representative Hurtas's comments, if the provider tax drops off, I mean, how does that impact the governor's budget? Or how does that, what's the impact of that? And it maybe that's not for this committee, maybe another one. But, I mean, what is the impact?
Mr. Bowerly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Marquardt, I am not fully versed in the full amount of the impact, but that funding stream right now is being used to provide Minnesotans with access to health care through their insurance, which is Minnesota Care, or through Medicaid medical assistance. That is being partially funded by this provider tax. And there are also important health programs across the state. Representative Hurtas, as you mentioned, we have two significantly large community hospitals in the metro area. There are also community hospitals and providers across the state who receive grants that are funded by this program to help make sure that they can provide access across the state. So I think the question would be, how are we going to continue to be able to help those people who are currently served but with this revenue stream if that revenue stream goes away?
Last comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just, just with what might be happening on the federal level, and that's going to have impacts on the state. And I just, and I know there's still a year or two, 2019 before that tax expires. But, I mean, it is something the state's going to have to look at. If the Medicaid, how all that works out, just we might be revisiting that some with even some information we don't know today, possibly. But thank you.
Thank you, Lee Marquardt. We do have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Schultz moves the minutes of February 28th, 20, and 17. Any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your comments, Representative Marquardt. Just to give you some insight on that, in carrying this bill for HCMC, for example, there's just one hospital is paying $12.5 million of provider tax. That's money that they have to spread around in how they generate the revenue to balance the books. And so that's largely going on the backs of people with private insurance and a burden, I believe, to the individual market. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The next item I'd like to share with you is around a sales tax exemption for charities. One might assume that if an organization is exempt for one tax type, it would be exempt for all tax types. In Minnesota, however, state law requires different treatment depending on the tax type. Minnesota income tax laws follow federal 501c3 laws, but Minnesota sales and use taxes do not. This means that not all purchases by charities are exempt from tax, and the department has to inquire further to determine the purpose of a purchase before it would be eligible under our current statute. So the proposal would be to extend the federal, for any 501c3, the sales tax exemption for those charities to include sales to all of those types of organizations with a state sales tax identification number.
So, Commissioner Barley, my bill cleans that up. My bill cleans that up.
Your bill does clean that up, Mr. Chairman. And so does the governor's proposal.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm now going to turn it over to Mr. Cummings to address a number of updates and corrections. Many of these, Mr. Chairman, have been heard by this committee before and are relatively small items, but important to keep our tax code working well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. As Commissioner Bowerly mentioned, I will be presenting needed updates and corrections to Minnesota's tax code. Article 6, Sections 3 and 4 deals with the compressed natural gas definition. This was included in the tax bill that was passed but not enacted last year. We thank Representative Garofalo for his leadership in carrying this legislation as a standalone bill. This proposal updates Minnesota's definition of compressed natural gas by adopting the International Fuel Tax Agreement standard. This provides a simpler, easier to understand tax for businesses and is requested by the industry. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith's proposal would align the energy content of CNG with the industry standard, adopt the industry standard conversion rate for tax purposes, and reduce the fuel tax rate for CNG to keep it aligned with the current gasoline tax rate. Wanted to present some sales tax clarifications. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith recommend three important clarifications to the sales tax code. The first proposal is the equal treatment of digital products. When digital products became taxable in 2013, the law was written to tax only specified digital products and does not include all products that are taxable in their tangible form. This causes a non-parallel effect in law that produces inequities between similar products and can be unclear for businesses and taxpayers. There's also confusion among taxpayers as to why something is taxable when it is sold as tangible personal property, but not when it is sold as a digital product. In 2013, that bill already provided parallel taxation of e-books, digital music, and greeting cards. With changing technology, more tangible products are being sold in digital form. The second proposal in the sales tax clarifications deals with computer installation labor. Currently, terminology, timing of the service delivery, and the timing of the billing make it difficult for businesses that are selling or purchasing these services because these sales include both non-taxable and taxable labor. For instance, consulting services related to pre-written software can be both taxable and non-taxable. Consulting services, that is, customer support services, is non-taxable, where software installation labor is taxable. Keeping track of what is taxable and what is not taxable is complicated and become confusing. Other taxpayers may change their billing to include more non-taxable services, and then we are left to determine if that was the correct designation. It is very difficult to separately state all of the items that go into the purchase of module-based computer software programs. This difficulty stems from the fact that the different labor components of the purchase of the software, whether performed by the seller or third party, often happen simultaneously or overlap each other. This would treat the installation of pre-written computer software the same as the installation of tangible personal property. The third and final sales tax clarification relates to burial containers. Minnesota law currently exempts caskets, vaults, alternative containers, coverings, and linings for human burial. Over time, more taxpayers are renting or leasing caskets rather than purchasing them because the deceased will be cremated after the viewing or visitation. When the casket is being rented, it is not being used for human burial and therefore not exempt from the sales tax. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith recommend expanding the sales tax exemption for burial containers to include all caskets and alternative containers used for viewing, transportation, or burial of a deceased human being. I was asked whether whether urns, Mr. Chair, that would be displayed would be taxable. Under current law, urns that would be displayed would be taxable. Under the proposal, they would be exempt, Mr. Chair.
How do you know, Mr. Cummings, if you're in a rented casket?
Mr. Chair.
Ask the decedent.
Mr. Chair, there, as a family is going through the difficult process of with a funeral home or a cremation society, you know, they're part of that contract would be the rental of that casket in order for the viewing. So that is something that is very clear that they would be using a casket for a short amount of time. Now, there, I have been told that there are sort of liners or other things that are put inside of a casket, but this is, I know, an issue that has come up.
Representative Hertaus.
Well, I just, Mr. Chair, I guess maybe the Department of Revenue is really talking about getting rid of a death tax.
In a limited form. Chair Gaskowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus beat me to the punch. I'm sorry.
And I have to preface this. I carried the legislation for the funeral home directors in early 2000s, because it hadn't been rewritten since like the 1940s. So I carried all that, and so I know far more about that than we need to know here today. So please continue, sir.
I'll now move on to the Minnesota State High School League exemption proposal found in Article 6, Section 1 and 11 of the bill. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith recommend providing an exemption from sales and use tax for admissions to postseason games, events, activities sponsored by the Minnesota State High School League. The savings from this exemption must be used to promote high school extracurricular activities. The Minnesota State High School League provides educational opportunities for students through interscholastic athletics and fine arts programs and provides leadership and support for member schools. Wanted to just speak briefly about the Medelia sales tax exemption. The governor and lieutenant governor propose an exemption from the sales and use tax for building materials, equipment, and supplies used to construct and replace property in Medelia that was affected by the fire on February 3rd of 2016. So for this, taxpayers must pay the tax on the purchases and send a claim for refund for the tax.
Excuse me, Mr. Cummings. So Representative Anderson, Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cummings, you've done the sales tax exemptions for many different communities. Have there been any problems for communities to do the sales tax exemption in the past, or do you anticipate any problems for Medelia in doing it in the future?
Mr. Cummings?
Would there be a problem for these types of businesses to get the refund? Is that what you're saying?
Chair Anderson S.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Cummings, for any community, whether it's a city or in the case of Medelia, you've got businesses that are doing the sales tax exemption. Have they ever run into problems in getting the sales tax information from the construction companies that are doing the work for them or getting the materials or anything like that? Has the agency ever run into any problems with that at all?
Mr. Cummings?
We, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, so in this case, we haven't heard of that issue that has come up. We know that there are other issues that deal with sales tax exemptions, and, you know, for school districts or for cities or other things in terms of trying to how to bid a contract out. But in terms of these type of sales tax exemptions, I haven't specifically heard of any issues. I can sort of keep my ears open for that, though.
Chair Anderson has.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Cummings, so, you know, we've got, like, the Minneapolis has done it. Have they run into any problems in getting that detail from the contractors that they have worked with? And then does the department provide assistance in getting that data at all, or how does that work? What kind of assistance do you offer in that regard?
Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chairman and Chair Anderson, the department has sort of a helpline, if you will. We work closely with communities, whether it's for the local option sales tax or for seeking these types of refunds, to provide them with information before they get started so that they know what they are, what they will need to be able to provide to the department to claim that refund. And, of course, different refunds have been constructed in different ways by the legislature, so upfront would obviously be different than a refund scenario. I'm not aware of issues with respect to that, but I think we'd have to do some checking, and I'd be happy to check with the division who deals most directly with those local governments and these refunds, and we can get you more information about any of the issues that we know that are being experienced by those local governments as they seek those refunds.
Chair Anderson asks.
I think that helps for now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Chair Anderson. Chair Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a quick question. I think that's a good provision relative to the State High School League. But my question is, what's the status then of our colleges and universities? Because I think you could lay the same argument for many of our colleges and universities that that revenue could be used by a college or a university. And not all of them are first division schools that probably sales tax one way or another, if they've got a good team, isn't going to make a whole lot of difference. But, you know, some of your state universities that would be maybe second division or third division or a community college sports program, is there any discussion in that regard?
Mr. Cummings. Mr. Chair, and Representative Carlson, you know, this was something that came out of the talks originally, I believe, with the Twin Stadium, if I remember correctly. And so part of the issue there was how do we use our sort of facilities across the state in order to ensure that that happens. Some people came forward to say, you know, how do we ensure that, you know, high school students, that sometimes it's very difficult to travel 6 hours down to the cities or to Rochester or to Duluth or wherever this activity is happening. How do we make sure that there's opportunities for them to be as engaged as everyone else? So as it relates to collegiate sports or other types of admissions for a whole, you know, for the many, many items that we charge admissions to, I think that there is sort of an openness. I know we have talked about taxable admissions in many regards, and what should be taxable and what should be exempt. So, you know, we're open to hearing the continued conversation. I know that Representative Petersburg has worked on the taxable admissions related to the Farm America down in his neck of the woods. So taxable admissions and how that money is used and for what purposes is an open question.
Mr. Chairman, another question. I'll do a little can't really say constituent service, but I stopped off for breakfast this morning, and as sometimes happens to those of us that are in elective office, I got stopped on the way in, and the fellow said, I got a question of you, Representative Carlson, and it deals with what's exempt and what's taxable. He said, why is the driveway, when I have it plowed out, my sidewalk and all of that, and I hope I'm framing this correctly, tax exempt, but when I have my yard service, there's a sales tax charge. I said, I'm surprised at that. I would assume it would cover both, but I said I would check on it, and being that we're talking there this morning about what's exempt and what's not exempt, if either of you have an answer to that question, I told him I'd get back to him.
Ms. Dalton, to the Carlson question.
Well, I thought maybe the commissioner would know the answer to that one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, lawn care and garden care were added to the taxable services, I believe, back in 1987, but snow plowing was not.
So was, Mr. Chairman, a legislative decision that one's exempt and the other is not?
Chair, Representative Carlson, that's correct.
And knowing this fellow, I've met him before, and I'm sure that he probably wasn't advocating to pay more sales tax. He was probably coming at it from the other side, but thank you.
Okay, thank you. So with the State High School League thing, I mean, that's intriguing, the Carlson question, as far as, like, for universities. So how would that affect the Winona State?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Cummings.
Members of the committee, so the Minnesota State High School League exemption found in this bill would ensure that as the Winona State hosts various Minnesota State High School League functions, state functions, and that the Minnesota State High School League uses some of the scholarships that is set aside in order to ensure that students can go to functions that could be at places like Winona State, that they could offer that opportunity to do that. Now, this doesn't have any impact on any taxable admissions for, you know, any Winona State intercollegiate activities going on.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I'll now continue to talk about the siding facility exemption found in Article 6, Section 13 and 14 through 16. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith recommend providing sales and use tax exemption on building materials and supplies used to build a siding production facility that can produce at least 400 million square feet of siding per year. This will provide jobs in a part of the state that has been hit hard by the global steel market. Wanted to move on to the motor vehicle leases. This was included in House File 848, and I wanted to thank Representative Petersburg for carrying this in last session and now in this session, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Cummings. And I do appreciate carrying that bill for you. But because we're talking about transportation, this is the first time we've really talked about it here. I am curious as to what the governor's stance is on the taxing policies in regards to funding transportation. The governor, like I, am very concerned about our investment in transportation and how we fund that. But I haven't heard any presentation so far in regards to the funding mechanisms that he's recommending, and I believe that would be part of this taxing committee as well. Do you have any follow-up or information in regards to that, or is that going to be talked about later?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Petersburg, the governor's transportation proposal is a comprehensive proposal. It does include the proposal he had last year, which was gross receipts change for Minnesota. That bill is traveling as a package together. Mr. Chairman, I am no expert on committee jurisdiction, but I anticipate it would wind up here as well. But it's not a part of our presentation here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I'll be looking forward to having that discussion, and maybe when it comes back here, we can have a further discussion as well. So thank you.
Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and either Commissioner or Mr. Cummings. On the siding production facility, can you refresh me again? What's the amount that they're looking to generate from the sales and use tax exemption?
Mr. Cummings.
One minute here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the sales and use tax exemption would be for $1.4 million in fiscal 18, $2.8 million in fiscal 19, and $1.4 million in 2020.
Chair Anderson, S.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Cummings, is there any anticipation that they won't be able to generate that revenue at all? And has, in any of these situations where you have sales and use tax exemption, have you ever found that they haven't been able to generate the revenue or get the revenue that they need to do their project? Because I assume that they're probably expecting to get the amount here. What is it, roughly a little over $5 million, maybe more than that?
Mr. Cummings?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, so this is something in which they would then pay the taxes and then apply for a refund. Mm-hmm. So they would need to, so in the case, you know, they would have to ensure that the conditions are met under the law, that they are meeting the qualifications of a facility that is able to produce this amount of siding, and then they could, they would have to pay the sales tax and then apply for a refund.
Sure.
Usually, there may have been instances in the past in which a provision was passed, and then because that activity didn't happen, then this didn't happen. But I have heard that this facility is something that is going to happen up here, and so it is expected. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, though.
Chair Anderson,
I think so, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Cummings. I'll probably visit with you more later on it, so thank you.
Please proceed, Mr. Cummings.
I wanted to continue on talking about the motor vehicle lease clarification, Mr. Chair. Under current law, transportation and transit accounts, as well as the general fund, are receiving all of the funds under the 6.875 sales tax on motor vehicle leases, rather than the 6.5%. In addition, the Department of Revenue is directed to transfer 0.375 to legacy funds. This amounts to a transfer of 7.25% of funds when a sales tax of 6.875 was collected. The Governor and Lieutenant Governor recommend updating the statute so that the revenue for motor vehicle leases allocates 6.5% of sales to transportation, transit, and general funds as directed under law, and 0.375 to legacy accounts. Taxpayers would not be impacted by this change, and then it fixes an error in our budgeting system. I wanted to talk a bit about the construction and demolition waste proposal. For non-mixed municipal solid waste, construction and demolition waste, industrial waste, and infectious and pathological waste, all of them are taxed at 60 cents per yard. Yet, they also provide an equivalency in statute for what it would be if it were measured by ton. The $2 per ton rate for construction and demolition waste has not changed in 20 years, and as waste hauling practices have changed, the tonnage for a yard of construction and demolition waste has also changed. The Governor and Lieutenant Governor propose making construction and demolition waste consistent with industrial waste and in line with other states' practices. It would increase the simplicity and understandability of the tax on solid waste by making the two methods consistent. As for industrial waste, it would provide authority for the Commissioner of Revenue, in consultation with the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, to determine and publish a conversion rate schedule each year. The Governor's proposal would not impact mixed waste, including garbage, refuse, or other solid waste from residential, commercial, and community activities. All waste facilities who measure construction and demolition waste by yard would see no change. Mr. Chair, I wanted to move on to the proposal related to non-ferrous mining. Article 6, Section 19 updates the taxation of non-ferrous mining. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith recommend replacing the net proceeds tax on non-ferrous mining with the gross proceeds tax at the rate of 2.75%. This tax would be imposed on the gross value of minerals sold by a non-ferrous mining company. While currently not mined in Minnesota, non-ferrous minerals include copper, nickel, lead, zinc, uranium, and titanium, to name a few. If any of these materials were to be mined, the companies extracting them would be subject to a net proceeds tax. This tax is paid in lieu of property tax, similar to how ferrous mining companies, for example, iron ore or ferrous or taconite, pay the production tax. The current tax is determined by calculating net proceeds, which are the gross proceeds from non-ferrous mining minus expenses. This creates a situation where non-ferrous mining companies, particularly in the early years of operating a new mine, might not have any net proceeds. This result causes a disparate treatment of this type of mining compared to ferrous mining that pay a production tax regardless of profitability, or to homeowners or businesses who pay property taxes regardless of their income. Active non-ferrous mines would not be subject to the property tax. The gross proceeds tax would be collected and distributed as the same way as the current net proceeds tax. The rate of 2.75 is intended to provide parity with the tax burden on ferrous mines. And if there are other ways of trying to find that equivalency, we are open to having that discussion. And finally, I wanted to talk a bit about one targeted tax relief proposal, and that is the Sustainable Forest Act. Incentive Act. Changes to the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act were initially discussed after a report by the Office of Legislative Auditor in November of 2013. Many of their recommendations are incorporated into this bill. It was important to acknowledge that the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act program provides economic and ecological benefits as well as tax cuts. This proposal updates and changes the SFIA eligibility requirements, certifications, covenant lengths, calculation of incentive payments, withdrawal procedures, transfer of ownership, definitions to forest land and claimants, and other minor changes. These recommendations are supported by Minnesota's forestry industry, and the legal summary provides a detailed account of the policy changes. I wanted to turn it back over to Commissioner Bowerly.
Before we do that, that's very good finesse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, on the non-ferrous mining tax proposal that you have, what's the amount of revenue that you're anticipating from that?
Mr. Cummings?
Madam Chair, I believe that the revenue estimate has about $6 million in fiscal 19, and then $10 million the year after that. I will check.
Chair Anderson.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Cummings, what's the thought process of having that go to local units of government and the IRRB rather than going to, say, the general fund to maybe address needs if there were any for environment, for the DNR and so forth? Sure. For MPCA, I should say.
Mr. Cummings.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, so the occupation tax is intended to be a tax that is levied that goes back to the general fund. And so that is something that is a mining tax that is intended to be in lieu of the corporate tax for these mines. Now, related to the production tax or the net proceeds tax, they are intended to be in lieu of property taxes. So instead of levying a property tax, once a mine becomes active, so right now those lands on or around that mine that is not being mined, they pay a property tax to the local jurisdictions like anything else. But once those mines become active, then they are exempt from the property tax, and then they are asked to either pay a production tax for ferrous mines or a net proceeds tax for non-ferrous mines. Now, the reason why we can do a simple production tax for taconite mines or ferrous mines is because that product has become so standardized. You know, taconite is so standardized that we can do per ton, and we can easily check the weights and measures, and it's and we can easily say what the tax per ton is. Now, for non-ferrous mines, you know, there is some ideas of what are the primary minerals that would come out of that mine, but if we were to put tax rates and statutes per ton or per ounce, we might have 20 tax rates, you know. So we're trying to find a way to provide an equivalency with the property tax, an equivalency with the production tax for the non-ferrous mines. And, you know, we haven't had the non-ferrous, net proceeds tax turn on. So, and then we're sort of looking at that tax, and is that providing the best equivalency to the production tax if that gets turned on? And we think that we have a proposal that does a better job at that, but we're open to continuing that conversation to try and come up with the best proposal.
Chair Anderson, yes. Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, on lines, this is under the Sustainable Forest, by the way, in Article 7. In lines 114.10, why is there a need for this extra language about the state forest land resources under the purpose statement?
Mr. Cummings?
Okay, could you just, what is the site?
11.
Chair Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Starting in line 114.10.
Mr. Cummings?
Because we have new language, Mr. Chair. The former language, thank you, Mr. Chair, has been deleted and new language added. And I'm just wondering why we've gone to this extent. And then there's another addition in line 114.14.
Mr. Cummings?
Well, one of the things that was brought up related to the OLA report, and one of the things that we were in discussion with the forest industry about, is what is the purpose of the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act? And, you know, one of the primary purposes before of SFIA was to deal with tax cuts, right? So then we're finding that forest land across the state has very different levels based on market value of sometimes of that forest land in terms of property tax. So part of the intention in terms of updating the purpose statement between the Department of Revenue, the Department of Natural Resources, the forest industry, other folks in the community, was to say that this is not necessarily just about tax reductions. It is about providing, you know, stewardship practices for our forests. Some there are instances in which the incentive, in order to maintain those high level of stewardship practices, nets to an amount that is above the amount paid in property taxes. So we want it to be very clear that this is about forest stewardship as much as it is about tax relief. So that is what that's what we're trying to get at. But these purpose statements are something that we can always do better at. Madam Chair, if you have any suggestions.
Sure. No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I needed that explanation, and I do think it is a reflection of the OLA report that was critical of the use of the incentives. However, you know, we're always adding language to statutes, and I can be just as guilty as anyone, so I need a justification. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Cummings, you mentioned that the Sustainable Forest Initiative Act, that there was some support for that from within the industry. If you go up to the previous slide for the non-ferrous mining, is there support from the range delegation on that issue?
Mr. Chair and members, we have been in conversation with the range delegation. We know that there has been. We have heard support. We've also heard support from many of the communities in terms of who would be receiving this. We continue to be in conversation. I don't think that the range delegation is sometimes necessarily always unanimous, but we continue to be in conversation to come up with the best tax here for the communities, for the state, and for the mining companies.
Well, I just wanted to check, because so the range delegation supports it, it's the Davids-Marquardt bill. If they don't, it's the Dayton-Smith bill. Just so you know. Okay, you want to wrap it up there? Or you did, I guess. Any closing comments?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for your time and your attention and your questions. We appreciate the opportunity to engage with you on these provisions. The governor and lieutenant governor's budget provides nearly $300 million in tax relief to Minnesotans and aid to local communities to provide essential services while reducing the pressure on local property taxes. It focuses tax relief on families and farmers across the state who are working hard every day to do their best for their families and their neighbors. And the tax bill, as a component of the governor's budget, provides significant relief while also making critical investments in education to fuel our future workforce and human services across the state. Mr. Chairman and committee members, as you all know, the new budget forecast came out yesterday. And so just by terms of process, wanted to share with you what will be next. The department will be repricing these provisions. As you know, there are sometimes adjustments that come with forecasts in terms of the costs that come with tax provisions. So we will be repricing those. The governor has said he will have more to say about his supplemental budget in the next few weeks. In the meantime, I do want to note that the forecast represents continued good news and the strength of Minnesota's economy, and also noticed that the Dr. Cal Makitas and the forecast itself has some significant caution about potential risks, particularly coming from federal policy changes. And so we look forward to working with the committee towards a tax bill that will continue the budget stability that has created this economic prosperity for Minnesota and provides targeted tax relief for Minnesota families. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate the time.
And thank you very much for your presentation, Commissioner Bowerly and Mr. Cummings. Any final questions for members? Otherwise, we'll get to testimony. Chair Drazkowski.
Just a comment. That didn't sound like a $3 billion tax cut from the department. What I gather. Well, was it $4 billion?
Chair Drazkowski, we're getting closer.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Commissioner Bowery, thank you, and Mr. Cummings, thank you for your presentation of the David Marquardt bill. Okay, so with that, we will go to, I'm going to start off if Ms. Cadoon and Ms. Larson could come down. 2 minutes, and we are timing, but we're very interested in what you have to say. You don't have to go 2 minutes, and you don't have to go 2 minutes. And also, is there anyone that is on the list to testify that is more than 50 miles from the Capitol? Because that would get you a bump up on the list. Okay. So please state your name and your reference for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Kadum. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We're on here to testify with our strong concerns over the governor's tax bill as well as strong oppositions to the business tax increase contained in the bill. First, I just want to mention our kind of general overall policy concerns regarding the governor's budget, where he's spending nearly 90% of that time a $1.4 billion surplus and only a net $54 million in tax decreases. And contained within that is over $100 million increases on our business community and our private sector job creators. So very concerned over those tax increases. The governor bill does seem to recognize that taxes can impact investment decisions, as it contains recommendations on targeted tax reductions for specific businesses. We believe that a much better public policy approach is to see how we can improve the competitiveness for all our businesses in the state, all around the state, regarding by reducing our uncompetitive business taxes. We believe that will strengthen our business climate and best position Minnesota for a strong private sector growth. Some specific items that we're concerned about are we're opposed to the retroactive tax increases contained in the bill. We always are opposed to retroactive tax increases, believing we should really be getting taxpayer notice on those and make those prospective. We're opposed to pending court cases when you're changing the tax laws, such as the financial institution provision, which is actually pending at the tax court. We're opposed to, there's a business-to-business sales tax on labor that's included in the bill on the software. We went down this path before, have learned some lessons on business-to-business taxes and hope we don't go there again. We're also concerned over the property tax change that's included in the bill regarding the railroad provision. This actually is preempted, we believe, under the Federal 4R Act, a federal law that does determine what states can do for valuation.
Can this committee wrap it up, please?
Okay. There's a severability clause in here that seems to recognize that well. If that goes away, there's actually a statewide business property tax increase of that's $927 million. That would be in the bill if that is preempted under federal law.
Ms. Kadum, we'll put you down as a maybe. Ms. Larson? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Jill Larson. I'm with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I am going to make just a few comments on some of our concerns with the bill, highlight the ones that are of most concern. With respect to the corporate tax provisions, Article 4, the economic substance provision, we are opposed to this provision. We have been in the past. We believe it gives the Department of Revenue's auditors too much broad discretion to essentially increase an employer's tax liability, even though that employer is following the law. We think the legislature should make the laws, not the department's auditors. If this were enacted, it would just create an enormous amount of uncertainty for taxpayers who won't know how the department may or may not treat a transaction because the language is just so vague and broad. We're also concerned about the language that will repeal the dividend received deduction for certain income. This is in Article 4, Section 17. This is a $66 million tax increase. We think it will negatively impact Minnesota-based businesses that are exporting their products around the world. It would make Minnesota an outlier. Our understanding is that virtually every other state allows this type of deduction, and it will make it more difficult for Minnesota companies to compete against their competitors globally. With respect to the sales tax article, we are opposed to the provision that would impose the sales tax on consulting services and implementation services for computer software. These are typically large projects. This will be a significant business-to-business sales tax increase. We do not believe this is simply a clarification of the law. It overturns a court case. As Ms. Kadum mentioned, we went down the road of taxing business-to-business services a few years ago, and those were repealed. So we hope that we don't do that again. And lastly, Article 6, Section 6, the taxation of digital products. This does appear to cast a very broad net to allow the department to tax many digital products that are not currently taxed. And we just think that it deserves a more robust discussion. It will repeal it will now tax webinars and continuing legal education that are currently exempt. So we oppose that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Perfect. 1.59. Awesome. Awesome. Thank you. And we won't be taking member questions at this point because I've got it just scheduled that we can do this before noon before we go to the floor session. So Brian Sweeney and Roger Aronson. And for folks that want to talk to members more, or members have questions, they're on the list here. Please get a hold of them. And by cutting off, if you think that I'm being rude, well, that's just too bad. Mr. Aronson, please state your name and who represents the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Roger Arnson. I represent the Minnesota State High School League. We want to thank the governor and the lieutenant governor for including the State High School League sales tax exemption in this bill.
Actually, it was Davids and Marquardt included it.
Mr. Chair, I was getting to the other thank yous here as well. And Representative Erdahl, who's authored the bill and that has already been heard in this committee. I think that Mr. Cummings did a nice job of describing some of the rationales for this. I might note for the committee that today is the opening day of the state wrestling tournament, and this committee actually has some wrestling experts here with Representative Detmer and Representative Marquardt and others. Yes, and the chair. Wrestling is a rather unique experience. I noticed that the skin check and weigh-in is at 4 o'clock. But Mr. Chair, all that aside, this is a very important sales tax exemption that does very good things for kids, parents, and families in our schools, and we appreciate the governor's support, your support, and other members, as well as Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Okay,
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer is going to be reffing.
As the chairman?
Mm-hmm. Tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Cool. Mr. Sweeney, please take your name as your representative for the record, please, sir.
Morning, I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. The rail industry is strongly opposed to Article 5 dealing with railroad property taxes. It would be a $60 million plus hit on the rail industry that we believe is a blatant violation of the 4R Act, the Railroad Regulatory Revitalization and Reform Act that was passed precisely because of these types of taxing programs. As I said, it would be a violation. The state has acknowledged in prior litigation that they cannot tax railroad personal property because they exempt other commercial, industrial, personal property as a class. That's the basis of the 4R Act. You can't treat us any worse than other CNI payers. You can make us pay our fair share, but you can't make us pay someone else's fair share, which is what this would do. There is some thought that perhaps because utilities, personal property is taxed, that would save this. It doesn't. There's an Eighth Circuit court ruling directly on point that says that is not sufficient to overcome the discrimination. There is some talk that because railroad docks and wharves are subject to personal property tax, that there's a precedent. In fact, while there is a statute on the books to that, in practice, the personal property portion of that is not taxed. Only the real estate is taxed. The valuation methodologies would put Minnesota out of step with the rest of the country, both in terms of the valuation methods that are used and also by having them placed in statute. Updating of the methodology should be done by rulemaking, which is the process for other industries. Finally, last week there was a question whether the tax increase would cut into grade crossing maintenance by railroads. Certainly in the case of the short line railroads, the small ones, it would cut not only into their capital spending programs, but it would cut into their maintenance programs as well. That was the condition of the rail industry as a whole. Back in the 60s and 70s, before this, another federal legislation was passed, there was a great deal of deferred maintenance. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have next Mr. Scott Grunquist and Grace Kelleher. They're up. Keith Carlson, Matt Hilgert on deck. Gary Carlson, Patricia Nauman in the hall. Okay. Please state your name if you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Scott Grunquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to offer a few brief comments. We would like to acknowledge and thank the governor for including debt service equalization, and you, Mr. Chairman, in your bill. This is an important issue for school districts across the state. You all know what a critical role property tax levies play both in terms of school operations and in securing safe and secure school facilities. And it's been unfortunate over the years that we lost a lot of ground to inflation in our debt service equalization program. And so this is an important step to bring back the purchasing power of that program. We would hope, Mr. Chairman and members, that you would actually build on the governor's recommendation, as is outlined in House File 1381, Representative McDonald's bill, to also address referendum equalization. And we really think equalization of debt service and operating referendum is a triple win. It provides tax relief, it provides tax equity, and also actually addresses education funding equity. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for the time today.
Thank you, Mr. Grunquist. Ms. Kelleher?
Good morning, members. My name is Grace Kelleher. I work for the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every elected school board member from around the state. Mr. Chairman, I will do my best to be brief. We are really excited the governor included the ag school building bonds. That was something we worked on a lot last year, and Representative Drazkowski gets a gold star for putting in the time with us and finding a solution that did not shift tax burden on to cities. And it was in last year's bill, Mr. Chairman, and I thank you for that. Just to give you an idea of how big this problem is, data is always good. If you look at how the metro area schools are passing capital bond projects, they pass about 26, and the metro failed. They had three fail. In outstate, they passed about 65, and it and out of 51. And so it shows, once again, that elections are really holding schools back. The farmers want to vote for kids. They just can't afford to vote for kids. So it would be really nice if you could get that back into the bill this year. I agree with Mr. Kuhnquist on the debt service equalization. It really, truly is about tax fairness. And this is something that is that almost dwindled down to nothing. So if we could start that program coming back. Last but not least, Mr. Aronson did a great job about the high school league. If you want one provision in this tax bill that's going to go help students, it's this one. And Mr. Chairman, we'd like you to include that this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. We'll now go to Mr. Keith Carlson and Matt Hilgert, and then Gary Carlson, Patricia Nauman. Please state your name and who represents the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I'm also testifying on behalf of Mr. Hilgert for AMC. He's at another committee hearing. I want to indicate our gratitude to the chair, the ranking member, and the governor for including $10 million for additional county program aid, Indian Child Welfare Act, out-of-home placement, and the riparian aid if you want counties to administer the new buffer law. Also want to indicate our gratitude for the inclusion of the public waters buffer aid, but I do want to emphasize that money only assists farmers who are affected by the public waters 50-foot buffer. It does not provide money for those farmers who are affected by the 15 or 1 foot or one rod buffer that have to be placed alongside ditches, so that will be a continuing issue going into the future. I also finally want to indicate on behalf of our organization that we do support the school bond ag credit. And one final issue is, while we appreciate the $10 million for CPA aid, I do want to indicate that is not enough to fund the formula change that is included in House File 609. If that formula were to be superimposed on the $10 million increase, 25 counties, 23 of which are greater Minnesota counties, would suffer an aid reduction. That I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We'll now go to Mr. Matt Hilgert.
Mr. Chair, he's not here, I believe. Yes.
Oh, I see we've got the Carlson brothers here. Keith Gary and his other brother, Keith. Yes, okay. So let's go to Mr. Gary Carlson, League of Minnesota Cities.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to testify in support of Article 2, Section 14 of House File 893. We appreciate you and the governor introducing the bill with the $20 million increase in LGA. That is an important step toward moving us back toward the funding level we last saw in 2002. LGA was frozen this last year. That created some pressure on property taxes. But again, we do support the $20 million as an important step toward restoring the LGA funding program. And I think that's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. I see the third Carlson, Brother Joel Carlson, coming up here. Patricia Nauman, and then Kane Knudsen, Joel Carlson. Ms. Nauman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, representing cities in the seven-county metropolitan area.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Governor Dayton for including the LGA increase in Article 2, Section 14 of House File 893. Metro Cities does support increasing the local government aid formula and program. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just want to echo the importance. It's being the only general purpose aid to communities, LGA is a key component of the state and local fiscal partnership. and the increase will go a ways toward keeping this program being functioning and adequate for communities across the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Katie Knutson and Joel Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Katie Knutson with the City of St. Paul, the future home of the Minnesota United professional soccer team. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I briefly just want to say that, as many of you know, we were successful in securing bipartisan support for the property tax exemption for the professional soccer stadium in last year's tax bill. Thank you to those of you on the committee who were instrumental in that effort. I also want to thank Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor, Chair Davids, and Lead Marquardt for including this important provision in their 2017 bill. The City of St. Paul supports the property tax exemption contained in this bill, which brings the stadium in line with every other professional stadium in Minnesota, and we look forward to working with the committee on this important project again this year. And Joel Carlson had intended to join me today. Unfortunately, he is testifying in the Public Safety Committee.
That is unfortunate. And if you could please give Mayor Coleman my best, I'd appreciate it.
I sure would. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let's go to Molly Moylanen, Joel Pickett, and Mr. Carnival. Please state your name and who you represent the director, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Molly Moylanen, and I'm with Clearway Minnesota. We're an organization dedicated to reducing tobacco's harm. I also co-chair Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation, a coalition committed to saving Minnesota youth from a lifetime of addiction to tobacco. Other members of our coalition include the Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota, local chapters of the American Heart and Lung Associations, and the American Cancer Society, among others. I'm here to express the coalition's support for the governor's proposal related to tobacco tax enforcement. Strong public policies prevent youth smoking and motivate adults to quit. Notably, keeping tobacco prices high is one of the most important tools for reducing smoking. And enforcement is a critical part of the equation. Improving enforcement will improve the overall impact of the policy. As outlined in the proposal, enforcement improvements include providing the Department of Revenue the authority and resources to do its job, requiring tax stamps on other tobacco products, just like cigarettes, and increasing penalties for repeat violators. When it comes to reducing tobacco's harm and preventing youth smoking, Minnesota has been a national leader. Once again, the proposal included in the governor's recommendation will become a national model for other states working to pass strong tobacco prevention policies with corresponding strong enforcement actions. Smoking is down in Minnesota because of our comprehensive approach, and these new proposals will ensure that we stay on the right track. Thank you, and we applaud the governor and the administration and the authors for taking these steps.
So just for the record, and Ms. Renzi, you might want to note this, Ms. Moylan, and you're supporting the Davids Marquardt bill?
Yes, sir.
For the record. You said yes, sir. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. I just always wanted to hear that. Okay. Mr. Pickett, Carnival, Harnack, Ongaro. Let's go to Mr. Pickett. Is he in public safety also? Okay, let's go to Mr. Carnival Harnack Ongaro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival, representing the National Waste and Recycling Association.
Welcome, Boston, committee, sir.
Boston College Eagles, Georgetown Hoyas, just for the record.
Oh, Hoyas.
We're here to support provisions in the governor's bill and your bill and Representative Marquardt's bill dealing with Article 6, the definition of compressed natural gas. It's non-controversial, it's bipartisan, it was in last year's House tax bill, and it encourages the use of compressed natural gas in waste-hauling vehicles. So all positive. We're also in favor or okay with the provision dealing with the tax rate on construction and demolition waste. Two very sexy issues, and I appreciate it. I yield back the balance of my time. Thank you.
They are paid turners, Mr. Carnival. Okay, Mr. Harnack on Garrow, and then Mr. Max Hall.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Ron Harnack. I'm representing the watershed districts for you today. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here, and the governor and Representative Davids and Marquardt's provisions relating to buffers in this bill. The riparian buffer compensation program in Article 2 provides a significant opportunity for compensation and helps landowners have a greater incentive for participation. And lastly, the bill also provides for buffer aid to local units of government, particularly counties and watershed districts, to assume program jurisdiction. Without this, I do not believe counties
or watersheds will take this program on, which leaves then only the enforcement coming from the state of Minnesota. There's $10 million to provide for that in aids payable in 18. Unfortunately, we believe that there should be an additional $10 million for aids payable in 17, as that is when the landowners have an obligation to put these buffers on the ground. And local units of governments need to have an opportunity to get their rules, ordinances, and so forth in place so that they can be the ones to work with landowners. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Harnack. Mr. Ongaro, Hall, and then Leto.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Frank Ongaro. I'm the Executive Director of Mining Minnesota, representing the non-ferrous copper-nickel industry in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today in opposition to the governor's proposal to change the net proceeds tax on copper-nickel mining to a gross proceeds tax and increasing the rate of that payment. But the only thing in the analysis and assumptions that I see that we could agree with in the governor's proposal is that they anticipate polymet mining to be up and running in 2019. Beyond that, increasing the tax from a 2% of net to 2.75% of gross is not fairness. It doesn't provide compatibility. It's not equity. It does nothing but chase investment away from the state of Minnesota on an industry that is not even yet up and running. 5 years ago, there were specific acceptable deductions and non-acceptable deductions. Those were repealed to put the non-ferrous net proceeds tax on par with the corporate franchise tax. Now there's some certainty and stability. This would chase that investment away and does nothing but provide instability. In iron ore, we have always provided incentives to invite investment in the state of Minnesota. This would do nothing but provide a disincentive. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Ongaro. Okay, Mr. Hall, Leto, and then Laura Sales. Mr. Hall, please state your name and who represents the record, please.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Max Hall. I'm the legislative representative at AFSCME Council 5.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So AFSCME Council 5 is a labor union representing more than 43,000 Minnesotans throughout the state, and we are here to speak in favor of the governor's proposal, the David Marquardt proposal. Sorry. And so specifically, we'd like to mention, like other testifiers, the increases in county program aid and local government aid. As a result of a lack of aid investments over the years, this critical investment is needed to be able to bring excellence in public services, which our members are very much in support of. And so speaking to the overall tax bill, we are in support, and we would just like to publicly thank the governor, Chair Davids, Lee Marquardt, and members of the committee for allowing their for putting input into this piece of legislation, as well as Commissioner Bowerly and others. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record also, I'm a Forsyth Ranger, so Representative Detmer is my rep. So thank you.
Thank you. To the next witness, to the David Marquardt bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brad Leto, Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and I'm here to support the proposal by Governor Dayton, authored by Chair Davids and Representative Marquardt. House File 893 increases and expands the working families tax credit, makes child care more affordable for tens of thousands of Minnesotans, and helps address some corporate tax privileges so everyone can pay their fair share. Working Family Tax Credit is not a handout. The credit is for working families to work and earn income and profit for businesses. Second, Minnesota's working families struggle with child care costs. Governor Dayton's and Chair David's and Representative Marquardt's tax bill expands the tax credit for dependent child care. Can more be done? Yes, but this is a very good expansion of the dependent child care tax credit. Finally, Minnesota working families play by the rules and they expect their employers and other businesses to do the same. Most do. Some businesses do not. Some businesses get special tax benefits that small businesses and working families do not get. It is time to change this and in turn show small businesses and workers the government and legislature have their back. We support the governor's efforts to stop the tax shelters that allow corporations and certain businesses to pay less than other businesses and individuals pay. And for these reasons, I'm cutting back here, sorry. For these reasons, we support the David's Marquardt bill proposed by Governor Dayton. Thank you.
Well, actually, I'm proposing it. Last I looked,
and we appreciate that.
Last I looked, the governor can't carry a bill. Okay, let's go to Laura Sales, Nan Madden, and then Ray. Okay. Please state your name and represent the record, please.
Sure. Chair Davids and members of the committee, my name is Laura Sales, and I'm with the Minnesota Nurses Association.
And welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you. We're a union of about 20,000 registered nurses who work in hospitals all across Minnesota and parts of Wisconsin and Iowa. Our members are advocates for patients at the bedside and anywhere else they can promote access to safe quality care. We don't normally testify in the Tax Committee, but we're here today in support of a small provision in House File 893, the language that repeals the sunset of the provider tax. The provider tax is currently set to expire on December 31st, 2019. The money generated from this tax funds Minnesota Care as well as other public health programs. Without this funding, Minnesota Care would likely end unless the legislature takes other steps to find funding for this program. Minnesota Care provides health coverage for about 100,000 working poor. These are people who make too much to qualify for medical assistance but don't have access to employer-subsidized insurance. MNA helped pass the original legislation that created the Minnesota Care Program in the 1990s because nurses see firsthand every day the effects of lack of access to health care. Patients are sicker when they come to the hospital because they haven't received necessary preventive care. Other families are worried about medical bills, so they postpone a doctor's visit until it's nearly too late. Taking away this option for health care by allowing the provider tax to sunset would likely force these people into plans that provide inadequate access to care or drop out altogether. That's why MNA supports the governor and Chair Davids and Representative Markwart's proposal to repeal the sunset of the tax.
Thank you very much. Now, Sales, are you related to a Wilbur Sales from Austin by any chance?
Is it spelled S-A-Y-L-A-S?
Yep.
Possibly. I don't know.
Ancestry.com and check it out.
I'm not from Minnesota originally, so I don't know.
Okay. Ms. Madden, Ray, Connery. Please state your name and who represents the director, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Governor Dayton's tax proposal is focused on Minnesotans working their way into the middle class, and it does that through expanding the Working Family Credit and the Child and Dependent Care Credit. More than half of all states have tax credits like the Working Family Credit that are modeled on the Federal Earned Income Tax Credit, which is one of the nation's most effective tools for reducing hardships among working people and children. Expanding the Working Family Credit would mean that more working families can meet their basic needs. It would help keep workers on the job because they are better able to pay for things they need to succeed at work, like reliable transportation. With this credit, workers can gain traction in the workforce and have the resources to deal with temporary setbacks. Research on the Federal Earned Income Tax Credit shows that most families receive the credit just temporarily for 1 or 2 years at a time. When parents can pay for their family's basic needs, they are able to provide a more stable environment, and that improves children's chances of success in school and later as working adults. The Working Family Credit also effectively reaches across the state, with about 28% of those who currently receive the credit being in Greater Minnesota. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for authoring this proposal last year. This is essentially the same Working Family Credit provisions that were in the 2016 tax bill. Another critical issue for working families is the high cost of child care, and we want to thank Governor Dayton and the authors of this bill for the proposal to update the Child and Dependent Care Credit to better reflect today's costs of care and to make more families eligible. And, of course, I want to also thank Representative Loon for her long leadership on this issue. This proposal in this bill is similar to her House File 1499. With today's tightening labor market and a coming labor shortage, the state's economic future depends on every Minnesotan being able to succeed in the workplace, and these two credits can help us meet that goal. Also, we are supportive of maintaining the provider tax, which would create some stability and maintain flexibility for the state to respond in an uncertain and changing federal health care landscape.
Thank you, Ms. Madden.
Thank you.
Let's go to Ms. Ray and then Chris Connery.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Renal Ray. I represent the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits.
MCM supports the expansion of sales tax exemption to all 501c3 public charities, found in Article 6, Section 10 of this bill, because it provides uniformity to a confusing area of law, and it is good public policy. This provision was initially introduced as a bipartisan-authored bill in 2015 and was included in that year's final tax bill. This provision was also introduced in House File 1396 this year, thanks to the bill's chief author, Representative Carlson, and Chair Davids, Representative McDonald, Representative Loon, Dabney, and Applebaum for your support of the sales tax exemption to all 501c3s. And also thanks to the Governor's Office and the Department of Revenue for their support. The rules around which organizations qualify for sales tax exemption and which do not are unclear to nonprofit organizations and is inconsistent across types of 501c3s. For example, an organization with both a scientific and an educational purpose would not qualify, but an organization that did similar work with an exclusively educational purpose would. This provision would fix this issue. At the end of the day, this proposal leads to more resources staying in the community that are used to advance missions. Please support this provision, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Chris Conry, Dan Quillen, and Krisnick.
Chairman Davids, members of the committee, my name is Chris Conry. I'm here today on behalf of Take Action Minnesota. We're a grassroots organization that advocates for racial, gender, and economic justice at a local, state, and federal level. I'm here today to speak in support of the proposals on corporate tax reform and to extend the provider tax. We support all eight of the reform proposals in the bill, but want to highlight just two of them. The proposal to prevent tax evasion, sometimes called the economic substance test, and the disallowance of the dividend received deductions for subpart F income from controlled foreign corporations. First, the economic substance test would give the state's revenue department the legislative direction they need to determine whether or not a business transaction was either substantive or purely designed to evade taxes. The disallowance of the dividends received deduction for subpart F income is a good example of this. In September of last year, the Office of the Chief Counsel of the IRS published a memorandum on this issue. In a nutshell, they concluded that in the case they were evaluating, the business was engaged in an intra-business transaction that moved taxable U.S. income into a foreign-controlled corporation. They found the transaction lacked both substance and failed to satisfy the substance over form doctrine. These are fairly rare and complex transactions, and not every business has access to advantages like these. In fact, per the bill's revenue analysis, the cost of the dividends received deduction is estimated to be $66 million in 2018-19 and $57 million in 2021, and that estimate is based on the reported subpart F income of just 60 companies. We also support the proposal to remove the sunset on the provider tax. The provider tax is one of the cornerstones of Minnesota Care. The health care coverage and therefore the health and well-being of over 100,000 Minnesotans depends on this and in part on keeping this cornerstone in place. It's a Minnesota solution that works for Minnesota families. Thank you, Chair Davids and Representative Marquardt, for authoring this bill, and thank you, everyone, for your time.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Quillen?
Mr. Chair, my name is Dan Quillen. I co-chair the ISAIAH Health Equity Team. ISAIAH is an organization of over 188 churches across Minnesota. ISAIAH supports that portion of the governor's budget and the David Marquardt bill that removes the scheduled repeal of the 2% health care provider tax. Repeal of the provider tax puts low-income Minnesotans at risk relative to receiving decent health care at affordable rates. The provider tax and Minnesota Care, which it supports, as you know, was implemented originally with bipartisan support. It is the bedrock that supports quality health care services for low-income and working poor Minnesotans. It is that portion of the health care system in Minnesota that is not broken. Given the uncertainties relative to the future funding of the ACA, it is foolish to remove the provider tax. To do so will exacerbate the state's problem relative to providing quality, affordable care to lower-income Minnesotans. Removing the provider tax inevitably will result in increasing health care disparities based on income and race in Minnesota. Despite
the recent problems in the individual insurance market, it is important to remember that Minnesota's health care system in 2016 was still rated the best in the nation by the Commonwealth Fund. The sustainable, dedicated revenue that comes from the provider tax is one reason why. Let's not jeopardize it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Quillen. Ann Krisnick, did I do your last name right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ann Krisnick, Executive Director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, made up of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota, encompassing about three-quarters of Minnesotans of faith. And we're here today in support of the Working Family Credit Expansion. I'd like to thank the Chair and Representative Marquardt for this bill. In our faith communities across the state, we see Minnesota's struggling families and individuals all the time, and a lot of our faith community leaders talk about how important the working family credit is, that people get the credit and they're using it to actually have money for a down payment on a reliable car or to pay for long overdue repairs, to save up for a down payment on an apartment in a safer neighborhood, to buy shoes and coats and medicine for their children, money that's almost always spent directly in the community in which they live. So this is really important for that reason as well. As you know, this is tax relief for working Minnesotans who are low and moderate income and really trying to work their way into the middle class. I want to call your attention to a letter that was provided by one of our sponsors, the Minnesota Catholic Conference. And I just want to read one line from that where they quote the previous pope, who's now St. John Paul II, noting, "It's urgent to promote not only family policies, but also those social policies which have the family as their principal object. Policies which assist the family by providing adequate resources and efficient means of support, both for bringing up children and for looking after the elderly." Really appreciate your offering this bill and urge all of you to support this, that it really promotes self-sufficiency for these lower-income Minnesotans. Thank you.
And thank you very much. I was going to cut you off for time, but you were quoting the Pope, and I would never cut you off. I'm just not going to go there. So, members, we have a few questions, and I do want to respect members' time to get over to the floor. So, Representative Groffel, Chair Groffel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for nonpartisan staff, Mr. Michael. So, the Earned Income Tax Credit right now at the federal level, it's got different reimbursements for single, one-child, two-child, and then three or more. Do you know, Mr. Michael, first of all, the first question is the state of Minnesota structured the same way where it goes one child, two child, three child for different amounts? And the second question is, I know at the federal EITC, I think it's a little bit over $4,000 is the maximum credit available. Do you know, what the maximum credit is under current law in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, the Minnesota Working Family Credit is structured slightly differently than the Federal Earned Income Credit. There are different levels for childless individuals and one and two child households. The Federal Earned Income Credit does not have a differential rate for three children or more, but there's a separate federal child credit that provides essentially that. So that's Minnesota does not have that. There are a couple, I think Wisconsin's version of the Earned Income Credit does have a differential for three children. So Minnesota does not provide more for beyond the second child. I don't know off the top of my head exactly what the maximum Minnesota credit is. It's on the order of about 40 to 50% of what the federal credit is, but we can get that number for you if Ms. Manzi may be here in the 2,000, it's around 2,000. I'm not sure. It's still slightly more than that.
2,000 is around 2,000.
Yeah. Chair Garofalo. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Michael. So combined federal and state, it's a little bit around $6,000. And, Mr. Chairman, this is my 13th year in the legislature, and I'm very reluctant to say this, So I want to be very cautious, but and I want to make sure Mr. Michael is available to hear me say this when I say it. But Mr. Michael, it's my 13th year in the legislature. I'm going out on a limb when I say this. Okay, Mr. Michael, I think you're wrong.
Ooh.
I, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Michael, my belief is that the federal EITC, it used to be child one and then two or more. I think they added a third one for three or more. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Michael.
Oh, sorry.
You are correct.
That's it. See ya.
The big day for Chair Garofalo. See, I used to try that. I used to try that with Mr. Pender. On it just it didn't happen that often like that. Okay, he was very good. And you're very good. Very good. Yes. Okay, we're some Grimhagen, Carlson, and then we're going to wrap it up.
I was just going to remind Mr. Garofalo that he's a short timer at 13.
That's right.
And then Chair Carlson, I was thinking the same thing. Russell Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a quick comment on the testifiers, especially those concerned about increasing taxes. You know, I hope other members are concerned, too, about increasing taxes on our businesses, because ultimately when a business has higher taxes, they just transfer it to the products that they sell or the services they sell. So they don't pay it. The people who consume their products do. It also makes us less competitive with neighboring states and also with global production. Specifically on the ferrous mining, to go from a 2% net tax to a 2.75% gross tax, I mean, that's going to be about a 15 to 20% increase in taxes. And mining is one of the three ways that actually grows prosperity. And with modern technology, we can do it in an environmentally friendly way. So I really see these types of taxes. They remind me of the words of Ronald Reagan, you know, when it comes to business. Government's philosophy, it says if it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. If it stops moving, subsidize it. Okay? I think we need to give the mining industry a little bit of breathing room and an opportunity to grow before we try to kill it and regulate it out of existence. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, with that, I'll wrap it up. I'll move House File 893 as amended to be laid over in the Tax Committee. With that, members, thank you for your bipartisan support on the Davids-Marquardt bill. And
I'm not signing on, David.
Yeah, Representative Grunhagen, I'd really appreciate if you become a co-author of the bill. So, to the public, if you have questions, please contact your legislator. If you have questions, go ahead and ask me. If you have tough ones, please ask Lee Marquardt. You'll probably get a better answer. Thank you to every testifier. Thank you to the testifiers. Thank you, department. Mr. Cummings and Commissioner Bowerly, thank you very much for your efforts. You put a lot of work into this. With that, thank you, members, for your work. Good government all the time. We're adjourned.